I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folker.
And welcome once again to Talking Biotech. It's our weekly podcast about biotechnology and its interface with society, with an emphasis on how we as scientists might be able to better communicate these ideas. And some of the things we're talking about are the newest innovations and the innovations that can really get people excited about new technology and not just traits that farmers care about, traits that everybody can get excited about. And with me tonight, I have our first co-host. Joining me from Tallahassee, Florida, is Karen Cyphers. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Karen is she's a vice president for research policy at the Sachs Media Group in Tallahassee. She's also an adjunct professor at Florida State University, and she teaches in areas of public policy and American government. And is somebody who I was really fortunate to get to know by just kind of two funny ways. That one strange email that didn't about, you know, she would be on campus and we'd have some time to talk about opportunities to mesh science with communications, which is something I like to do. And pretty soon we were working together in a couple capacities. So it's great to have her on today. Karen, can you... what were your big interests in the areas of biotechnology and how it can mesh with communications?
Sure. Well, you know, it's my heart has always been very drawn to science. And as a layman, you know, the question always comes up, what aisle of the bookstore would you walk to first? And science literature has always been where my mind has wanted to go. But I've never had necessarily the aptitude to do science myself. And I found myself in different roles in terms of American government and policy, with the desire to help shape the public policy environment in a way that allows scientists to do what they do best, which is discover things and invent things and improve our world. So when I started reading about transgenic technologies and GMOs, it really struck me what a barrier public opinion is and will continue to be in this area. And I wanted to try to learn as much as I could to try to step in and make a difference in any possible way that I could.
And really, I applaud you for this because the world needs more people like you, because the fact that you understand science so well and you seem to really get it, and that you understand policy so well, and you're also a communications, you're embedded in a communications firm, really makes you kind of a triple threat in terms of helping us disseminate and communicate these ideas well. And also, you're a mom, right?
I mean, that's right.
You also can appreciate from that standpoint how innovation and safe innovation can be important as well, right?
Absolutely. It's definitely, you know, the mom blog universe definitely has lots of screamers and lots of good material too, and it's hard to sometimes separate out what's good advice from crazy stuff, and that's something I'm still working at.
Well, it's important because the mom bloggers are an important group of people, because they're the ones who really we need to reach. They're the ones who have the most questions, and I understand their concerns. I totally get it. And so you're kind of a good person for us to have here to help us understand our messaging and how it may apply to that segment of the population. So today we're going to talk to Neil Carter from Okanagan Specialty Fruits and his release recently of the Arctic Apple. Is this something that you have read about or thought about at all in terms of how you might serve this in your family?
Right. So, you know, and so when I was first reading about the Arctic apple, some of those same questions came up. And I guess the first thing that crossed my mind is, in what way is this different or better than whatever they're doing to make the apples acceptable in the plastic bags now?
Is the idea of a non-browning apple attractive?
Absolutely. You know, especially, you know, kids are pretty famous for not wanting to eat things that look weird to them. You know, whether that's like a bit of crust that fell off, the pizza exposing the sauce suddenly makes that piece of pizza unacceptable to eat, or, you know, even so much as a sandwich cut in the wrong direction. And so, you know, my kids, and I know plenty of others, will see a browner apple and not want to take a bite of it when we all know it's perfectly fine to eat. So it would certainly, I think, maybe help reduce waste in the sense of, you know, less browning would mean more apple eating.
Well, just earlier when we were emailing back and forth, you had asked me if there were any cases of natural non-browning or natural cases of this.
Right. You know, so the first thing that crossed my mind when I was reading about the technology itself and the gene silencing, rather than technologies that insert DNA from a different organism, I was wondering how often that's possible to happen in nature on its own without any human intervention.
Yeah, it happens all the time. There's all kinds of cases of natural antisense that have been discovered, meaning that the gene sequence somehow is expressed in the wrong direction and produces an RNA that's complementary to an expressed RNA, which then silences, which excites the silencing system. Silencing is an interesting process that was actually one of the cool things that was studied in plants, actually discovered in plants before animals. And studies in, there were some interesting ones about antibiotic resistance being shut off in plants, long story there. But that when you added multiple transgenes, you would see other ones become inactivated. And the best examples came from petunia, where you would have purple petunias that when you added genes to make plants purple, would actually make them white. So you would actually be turning off the innate purple genes by adding a purple producing gene. And this was where these very curious patterns emerged and later were deciphered by Mello and Fire and a few years later in C. elegans in the worms. But what's really cool is Neil's trait of non-browning actually wasn't first happening in apples. In 1962, there was a breeder walking his rows looking at grapes in California and found one that was had a very strange variegated spore. So just a spontaneous mutation that was coming from the Sultana cultivar that was variegated. And when he looked at the grapes that came from it, they were not pigmented. They wouldn't brown from oxidative browning. They were yellow. And these are what we have today as golden raisins. So a natural example of a non-browning trait. And it turns out it's in the same gene that Neil naturally suppresses.
So if this were to happen in nature with no human intervention and an apple has the gene silenced for browning and a scientist or a farmer were to come upon that apple and figure out that whether or not they knew the mechanism behind it, that apple was resistant to browning and they were to somehow use traditional breeding techniques to make more of those apples, would you or science consider that to be a genetically modified food?
Well, that's where we get into the nuance of this discussion. I think that it truly does have genetic modification. Clearly, you've changed the genes, but that's not something that under the current definitions is considered a regulated product. And I think that's really the big difference between the breeding and that which people really don't care how it happens. Spontaneous mutations doesn't seem to matter. It's a change in a gene. We don't know what it is or where it is, but no one seems to mind. But if you change a gene that you understand, people get a little bit upset. And it's really kind of the paradox of this whole situation. So now we'll go ahead and talk to our guest today from Okanagan Specialty Crops, Neil Carter. Okay, this week on Talking Biotech, we're here with Neil Carter from Okanagan Specialty Fruits, and also joined by Dr. Karen Cyphers from Tallahassee, Florida. Neil, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Kevin.
Tell me a little bit about the Arctic apple and just the fundamental idea behind this. What is the concept behind the product?
You know, Arctic apples came into being because my wife and I are apple growers, and what we've seen is apple consumption decline steadily over the last 30 years. And what this means, you know, is apples aren't competing well with other competitor products, and whether that's snack foods or other fruits and vegetables or tropical exotics. But the thing is this is really counter to the overall trend of fruit and vegetable consumption, which has been increasing. And so we were looking at ways to get people to get back to eating more apples. And we realized it's kind of like the baby carrot, the cut carrot model. You know, that acted as a consumption trigger when you watched carrot consumption double, because you made it from, you know, something people put in soups and stews and bought in 2-pound cello bags to making it convenient in a snack bag, you know, baby carrots or cut and tumbled carrots, fresh cut carrots, as we call them. And so, you know, we really wanted to rebrand apples and make them more convenient and put them into food service. And to do that, you needed to get rid of enzymatic browning. You know, enzymatic browning has a huge impact, and I call it a headwind for the industry, and the fact that, you know, you get fruit losses and cullage created from harvest, post-harvest, packing, retail handling, all the way along the value chain. And so what an Arctic apple is really aiming to do is to deal with that sort of post-harvest handling losses and getting rid of that superficial scuffing and bruising that happens on apples, and make it so that you can slice it without having to put an antioxidant on it, and preserving that great flavor. And we really know, having, you know, a lot of years experience now with Arctic apples, that it's a game changer. People are going to be very excited by this product.
How exactly is it done? Can you talk a little bit, in really simple terms, what is the process that's being used to generate this product?
The gene that drives the browning reaction is an enzyme called polyphenol oxidase. And polyphenol oxidase reacts with the phenolics in the apple cells and makes a brown pigment. So what we've done is we have turned off the polyphenol oxidase enzyme. So that enzyme's not being expressed, and you don't get the brown pigment being formed. And the way we do that is that we have identified sort of some targets gene sequences of polyphenol oxidase in apple and reinserted them into the apple. So what happens is that you get what's called a double-stranded RNA. You know, people may understand that, you know, DNA is a kind of a double helix type of structure, and RNA is made from the DNA. So what happens is we kind of harvest, or we attach ourselves to a natural occurring plant defense mechanism, where when a plant's reading the RNA to make protein, if it sees an extra copy of a gene, it chops it up. And that's called interfering RNA. So essentially, what we've done is we've turned off the gene using apple's own gene.
It's a really interesting strategy, because you're, and just to clarify for everyone who listens, this is really a really kind of using a natural process to turn off a gene. It's something that every plant cell does very well. Karen, it seems like you have another question for Neil.
Why would I want to purchase an apple that naturally doesn't brown versus one that's been treated with some kind of preservative?
You know, the thing with using an antioxidant to control browning is that you generate a fair bit of off flavoring, and so that, you know, what happens is that you really lose the natural apple flavor, and you get a fair bit of ascorbic acid or citrus kind of zing to the apple flavor. And in addition to that, most of the antioxidants used are calcium ascorbate or something like that. Mm-hmm. And You know, they're very reactive. They react with the bags. They're a challenge to work with in the industry to make a high-quality apple slice. So we think that if you can get rid of that antioxidant, we know we can deliver a higher quality apple slice to the marketplace, really at a lower cost point, because we're going to be getting rid of an expensive additive. The antioxidant, in some cases, it will cost as much as the apples themselves.
And the question on everybody's mind is always the question of safety. And so what kind of testing did these have to go through, and how long did it take?
Yeah, well, it's an awful lot of work. I think it's important to note that, you know, we're a company of 8 people. So for us to do the regulatory undertaking in both Canada and the United States with 2 agencies, FDA and USDA in the United States, and Health Canada and Canadian Food Inspection Agency in Canada, it's a huge, huge undertaking. I often say that it's like doing, you know, 3 or 4 PhD theses. So if you think of our work, we collected data for 5 years from the field and had a big data set. We did a lot of statistics on this data to prove that Arctic apples were the equivalent of their parent and conventional apples. We did all the molecular characterization of these apples. And ultimately, this accumulated into a very large scientific technical document that was put in front of these regulatory agencies. And then they spent 5 years reviewing it, asking us questions on it, scrutinizing it, and to the point where, you know, some of the letters they sent us asking questions had 26, maybe 30 more questions. And, it would take us half year, or even in some cases took us a year to answer those questions. And so it was a very, very high level of diligence by the regulatory agencies. And it's a very arduous undertaking, and 5 years from submission to approval. So it's a tough go.
And so what kind of response did you get, say, from the apple industry? Are they excited about the product, or do they kind of anticipate any pushback, or what do you feel is the case there?
Well, it's interesting. I'm going to answer that question in sort of the pre regulatory approval and then post regulatory approval, because things really have changed quite a bit for us. And prior to regulatory approval, there was a lot of wait and see in the industry. Kind of people wanting to be second. They want to be the first to go second. That's the comment we hear a lot. Nobody wanted to be first in line because they were concerned about the GM food headwind and challenges and the consumer reaction to that.
So how have members of the public reacted so far to the regulatory approval and to hearing about Arctic apples? Has there been excitement or willingness to engage with the product?
But since deregulation, I think that people are now excited about the product. We've had more opportunities to show it off, and people have had more opportunities to experience it. And they realize, and at the same time, we've had an awful lot of consumer excitement and positive feedback on it. And so now we're seeing a lot of interest, more interest than we actually anticipated even, so to the point where, we're very keen to drive this business forward extremely fast.
Neil, one of the big differences between this particular product and previous products, biotech products, is that you've been extremely forthcoming in speaking to the media and your visibility around just even on Dr. Oz. And how much do you think that your willingness to talk about the Arctic apple changes the acceptance and the dynamic around it?
Well, Kevin, I really don't have any idea how much we will change things, but from our own company's perspective, we, right from the outset, wanted to do this differently. You know, I'm a firm believer in transparency, education. We wanted to engage with the consumer and the public and answer their questions and try to have that conversation with them that allows us to get them on board and become champions, really, and help us with bringing this to market, because it's an exciting product. It's an exciting technology with tremendous potential down the road to improve all sorts of fruits and produce in general, reduce the needs for sprays and make crop production more environmentally sustainable. And so really, we're trying to open the door for produce in general with Arctic apples, and I'm encouraged. I think that things are going well for us.
I'm encouraged, too. I've been really surprised by the general level of excitement about the product, which I think is encouraging. I guess the one thing maybe that I would ask you about, were you surprised at the internet backlash in some cases, like some of the persistent comments during the public comment period, or even like when it first was announced that it was deregulated, you could go online and see pictures of people with, like, you know, the witch holding the Monsanto apple. And does it surprise you that people have these things confused?
You know, no, because really the general public knows really very little about the food they eat and the companies that are involved in the science, other than Monsanto. You know, everybody, Monsanto, everybody knows about them and likes to criticize the company. But, I think that we've just got thick skin over this process, but we knew that we would have people during the public comment period that would say nasty things. We've been receiving nasty emails for a long time. You know, it's taken us a long time to get where we are, and over that process we've had numerous sort of cycles of media and attention and negative comments flowing into our website and things. It's very cyclical. Every few years it seems to happen. But the difference has been really in the last this last cycle is which has been really wonderful for us, is that we've had a lot of people stepping up and defending us. We don't even have to engage with the naysayers. People are doing it for us. And, I'm interested to go on our Facebook page and things sometimes and seeing how, there's a negative comment and somebody else has addressed it before we've even had a chance to. And, so it's all good in that the discussion's happening. Ultimately, the consumer makes the decision. And when Arctic apples hit the market, the consumer gets to decide whether they want that product or they don't. And we certainly know not everybody will want to eat an Arctic apple. That's their choice. You know, some people eat organic, some people don't. Some will eat Arctic, some people won't. That's just the way it is.
We hear a lot from consumers that they might be all right with GMO foods as long as they are labeled. How have you and Arctic Apples approached this issue of labeling?
Yeah, that's a tough one, and I'll admit I'm conflicted on it myself. I don't want to demonize the technology by sticking a label, a GM, this is a GM apple or something on there. I think what we've really basically done is taken the position that Arctic apples will be labeled, and they will be labeled Arctic apples. And it's, part of us building a brand, but it's also part of us making sure that people who eat an Arctic apple know they're eating an Arctic apple. And given the media attention we have and when we go to market, we're anticipating, point of sale of information and links to our websites and, full disclosure and full transparency around the product. And so I think people are going to know this is that GM apple. There's been a lot of attention to it. So, that's sort of the approach we've taken. We really would hate to think that you spend 5 years or really 10 years, 5 years collecting data and 5 years in a regulatory process, only to come out of that regulatory process where they've made it, a statement that it's as safe as any other apple, and now they're now you're forced to slap a label on there that is really not, it's all it is doing is making the people scared and sort of, as I said, demonizing the technology. So that's the approach we're taking. We will have the label. It'll be labeled Arctic. And we'll be transparent, and people will know what the product is, and we're all for consumer choice.
Neil, one thing that stands out as interesting to me is how the Arctic apple allows consumers to tell the difference between enzymatic browning and rotting. How would you explain this to consumers who may not feel confident in their own ability to tell the difference between those two things?
I think it's important to understand that we've controlled enzymatic browning in the apple, and if an apple has gone rotten or has mold or has any kind of secondary pathogen, bacterial or fungal pathogen, those bacteria and enzyme and fungi have their own enzymes, and they make the apple go brown. So really, it's the exact opposite. When an Arctic apple goes brown, it means that there are pathogens there that are making it go brown. If it's not brown, well, then you know it's good to eat. So if, you know, you can still tell if an Arctic apple is rotten, because we didn't do anything to control the browning associated with rot.
The other question that I frequently see from concerned people is, what about pollen drift and gene flow?
Well, I think it's really interesting for people to know that in a commercial apple orchard, like our apple orchard here, every 60 feet down the row, there's a pollinizer tree. So, you know, pollen in an apple orchard is, you know, it's sticky. It's sticking to the stamen and the flower. And bees move the pollen around. And we to try to encourage bee movement in the orchard, we put these pollinizer trees every 60 feet. And the reason they're every 60 feet is because the bees really don't go very far. When the orchard's in bloom, there's a saturation level of pollen. They don't have to go far. The pollen's right there. So it's, I think, important to understand that, you know, that through managing the bees and the hives in an orchard, you don't get much bee movement. And so the pollen doesn't really go anywhere. But the other thing is that all of the apples, we use crab apple trees as pollinizers because crab apple trees have lots of flower, lots of pollen, and apple trees have to be cross-pollinated to get a fruit. And so really all the fruit in our orchard has crab apple genetic material in it, and we don't care. Nobody cares, because what it is, it's only in the seed, and it only represents about 5% of the paternal tissue of the seed. And so it's going to be exactly the same in an Arctic orchard as a crab apple tree. You know, Arctic pollen will move slightly. You know, I'm saying 30 feet, 40, 50 feet, not miles and miles. It doesn't blow in the wind or anything like that. And then if it did pollinize, an Arctic pollen pollinized a conventional apple tree or even an organic apple tree, you would get a small amount of that Arctic DNA expressed in the seed, in the paternal tissue of the seed. So really it's a non-issue. You know, everybody likes to dream that it's, you know, going to change everything and the pollen's going to fill the valley with the Arctic pollen and every tree is going to be contaminated. That's just not the situation. That's you know, the situation of a wind-pollinated type crop. It's not the situation in the fruit industry at all.
So, Neil, if you gave me a last punchline, one thing for us to leave with about the Arctic apple, what would that be?
You know, in doing this project, an Arctic apple was, you know, that the whole mantra behind Arctic apples is to increase apple consumption. You know, apples are known to be a very healthy food and healthy snack food. And what we are looking for is a day when, you know, apples are in a bag in the fridge and can be pulled out and poured into a bowl and the kids can eat them after school. Apple cubes can be poured onto your cereal. They can, ready to eat. Apple Betty can be apple crisp or something. Fresh apples can be poured out of a bag and made, put in a bowl and cooked right in the spot. And basically, you know, more apples in more places. That's what's the key driver for us. And we think that it's good for the apple industry and it's good for the consumer. And it's, you know, helps fight things like, you know, obesity and other issues that are really endemic today.
Can I ask you about your pipeline? Are there more Arctic pears or Arctic cherries in the making?
Yeah, you know, I think our focus is really on Arctic apples and getting more Arctic apple varieties into the marketplace through regulatory approval, through what's called an extension process in the United States. It's a similar process in Canada. It doesn't have the same name, though. And so, you know, more Arctic apple varieties is the first step. We are also keen to work on getting Arctic pears out there. We have, you know, ongoing work in that area. Cherries are a problem in the fact that they're difficult to work with, they're hard to transform. But ultimately, you know, we would love to see a grocery store that has a whole section dedicated to Arctic produce, whether that's fruits or vegetables, but a whole host of things. And, you know, we'll keep everybody informed how we're, the progress we're making on that.
Yeah, I really need an Arctic avocado because my guacamole goes brown, and I like making it in gallons. And so it spends, you got to eat a lot really fast because, you know, avocados are on sale. You want to make hay while the sunshine. And you end up with this second day avocado brown gray mush that doesn't do the job for you. Karen?
Well, Kevin, I'll just a comment on that. We probably have two emails a day or two comments come to our website a day suggesting avocado. It's clearly in everybody's mind once they start thinking about an Arctic apple and not going brown. They start going, hey, well, what about avocado?
Thank you, Neil, for spending time with us. This was fascinating and leaves me feeling very enthusiastic, not only about the technologies that are emerging, but also about the public's reaction to that and the possibility that there's going to be a whole lot more acceptance of these technologies coming through the work of folks like you.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us, Neil. I've been a big fan of your product ever since I read about it, and really see a niche for this, and more people to get more access to healthier food is always a good thing in my mind. So thank you and wish you more success in the future. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this with you today.
Yeah, that was Neil Carter from Okanagan Specialty Fruits talking about the Arctic apple, which should be in a produce section near you soon.
What can you do to help spread science through Talking Biotech? Our goal is to advance discovery to application with communication, ensuring the best technology reaches farmers, consumers, the environment, and the needy. Talking Biotech podcast is 100% funded by the Kevin Folta Family Vacation Budget, and no contributions or advertisers will be solicited or accepted. What you can do is kindly take a few minutes and write a short review of this podcast on iTunes, tell a friend, or scratch TalkingBiotechPodcast.com into a bathroom stall at Chipotle. If you have any questions, send them to talkingbiotech@gmail.com or through Twitter @talkingbiotech. A podcast dedicated to these important issues is long overdue. Your assistance can help others find helpful information, will accelerate research, and bring innovative solutions to those that need them.
Now I know there's a lot of confusion about genetically modified organs. And I'm here to tell you that if you listen to Kevin Folta here, these questions will be answered.
Yeah, thanks, Jason, for giving me your input. Two really good impressions, another one I'll play later. Very good for President Obama checking in with the Talking Biotech podcast. If you do an impression or you just want to introduce a part of the podcast, please send in whatever you have to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. And with that, off to your questions.
We'd love to answer your questions. Just use the hashtag TalkingBiotech.
Yes, this is the section where I answer your concerns and your questions. And the first one comes from Joe G. I don't know where from. But Joe says that he listened to recent podcasts and is concerned because he has three kids and two of them have peanut allergies. And that he doesn't recall at his age people having allergies when he was a kid. And others say that it's because of GMOs, but it doesn't seem to be the case for him. It doesn't seem to resonate. He also said that because GMO food that we feed to cattle, that kids are hitting puberty faster. And does this play into that in any way? And really, what the right answer is no. The main part is that there's no comprehensible mechanism that could connect GMOs to allergies. I mean, there's, with some exceptions, I guess, but it's a long shot. And really, there seems to be other reasons for why allergies seem to be more prevalent. And what some of the most competing theories are the hygiene hypothesis. The idea that since we've been bathing ourselves in Purell and antibacterial soap and freakish cleanliness, and not me, I've never used Purell once, that there's this idea that the immune system is primed to respond to environmental insults. And so if you're constantly germ-free, the immune system isn't ready to rock and roll, and so it finds a job. That's a one competing hypothesis. The other idea about GMO in cattle food, leading to puberty. That, again, doesn't make sense. All we're doing is inserting DNA. The DNA encodes a protein. The proteins are the same ones in a lot of cases that you're eating all the time anyway. So BT protein is something that's being consumed in organic food. It happens anytime you're, probably every time you swallow, those enzymes are there, or those proteins are there. So not a real easy one for us to pin down a cause on other cases. The next one comes from Stacy S. She says she's not a scientist but has a question and wants to know if genetically modifying food and making it resistant to chemicals is something that's dangerous. Is this beneficial or does it hurt us? And that she saw the episode on Vice that really has influenced her thinking on this. And the short answer is that these are of tremendous benefit to farmers, that this technology does allow farmers to use less time, labor, and tilling, so less disruption of the soil, which is a good thing, and use a very low environmental impact, low toxicity herbicide that allows them to separate the weeds from the crop that is growing. So the plants are engineered with a resistance to the herbicide. That way you're only killing the weeds that and not the crop itself. And what's nice is that about this technology is that this chemical called glyphosate is applied very early in plant growth. So early in growth, so long before there's corn or soybeans on the plant, the glyphosate is applied. And so it's long before anything that you would actually eat. And there's always a little bit of residue around, but you can't detect very much. It's always very small levels when it is found, if it's found. And it's a very safe herbicide, so you'd have to consume massive amounts of soybeans in order to even have close to what would be a biologically meaningful threshold. The amount that's applied to a field is about 750 milliliters so of active ingredient. So when people say they douse the crops in glyphosate, they're really saying, here's two pop cans of herbicide, go see if you can cover an acre with that. So it's not much of a douse. It's an amazingly safe and well-understood chemical. And people are using this one as really a scapegoat for the technology because people are not afraid of the food anymore necessarily, so they got to start villainizing the chemicals that are used in conjunction with them, even though they have been shown to be used very safely. So that's it for your questions for today, and we look forward to future questions either by using the hashtag on Twitter of TalkingBiotech or to TalkingBiotech@gmail.com.
Now it's time for Amazing Crop History.
So this is the part of Talking Biotech where we discuss the domestication and kind of human intervention into raising one of our major crops. And today it's an absolute pleasure to welcome Dr. Jonathan Wendell to Talking Biotech. Dr. Wendell, he's a distinguished professor and chair of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. He's been widely recognized for his work in genetics and genomics in cotton and making him a world's leading authority about the composition of our genes. Genes. Okay, good. Dr. Wendell, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here, Kevin.
So over the years, I've always learned a lot about or heard a lot about cotton domestication and that it was a really complex and reticulate history. I guess the central idea of where humans raised cotton was for fiber, but is that true? And what were the early days of cotton domestication like?
Well, that's a really excellent question. I think we have to start with what we mean by cotton. And so by cotton, what we mean is members of the genus Gossypium. And it turns out that there's over 50 species of Gossypium. And these are wild shrubs that grow in pretty dry places, mostly in southern hemisphere, from deserts to sort of seasonally arid environments. In Australia and Africa, South America, even one up into Arizona. And so it's a big genus, or medium-sized genus. And it turns out that four different species on different sides of the world were each independently domesticated by people, all four end products that we now recognize as cotton fiber.
And that's really interesting because you're saying that this is the same genus but found in different places. So is there an idea about where the original kind of founder center of origin is?
Yeah, it's such a great story. So we know that two of the cultivated species were originally brought into cultivation by Aboriginal domesticators in the Old World, probably in Africa and somewhere in the Indian subcontinent, respectively, and that two more species were independently domesticated in the New World, probably in Northwest South America and the Yucatan Peninsula in the New World. And so each of these independent domestications we've traced back to probably 7,000 years or so. There's an archaeological record for them. And so we have this multiple parallel domestication that took place by human cultures that had no contact with each other. And they were all just independently trying to make a useful product from these wild plants.
And were they all shooting for the same traits and the same kind of product? Or it would seem to be, I guess, cotton fiber.
Well, that's an interesting question. It's also an oil seed. And so there's a proposal out there that they were originally for animal feed, for non-ruminant animals, because the cotton seeds contain a toxin, a mammalian toxin, so it requires processing prior to human consumption. So when you go to the grocery store and you buy cottonseed oil, it's been processed to remove this toxin. The toxin actually causes sterility, and it's been used as a contraceptive in China. Male contraceptive is for that. As it is.
And so when we look at the improvement of cotton by early cotton domesticators, if we focus strictly on fiber, for instance, what did the early fibers look like, or what do they look like on the wild species that still exist today?
So cotton fiber is nothing more than seed hair. So each little thread that you might pull off a cotton bowl is a single cell. It's a remarkable cell. It's a highly exaggerated plant cell. It's nearly pure cellulose at maturity, and it can be up to a couple inches long. And so that's a remarkable single cell. That's bigger than some plants, whole plants. And the wild forms of the species have much shorter, more tightly adherent. They're not ginnable. This was the great invention, the cotton gin, that allowed for industrialization of the harvest, mechanization of the harvest. The wild species have seed hairs that are short, darker colored, tightly adherent, coarser in texture. And so the domestication process, four times from four different species, all created plants that had longer, stronger, finer, whiter cotton fiber, and it was on plants that were more productive, shorter, more annualized, etc. So the whole changes in plant architecture at the same time. So we're trying to get at the genetic basis of all these changes, because even though the end products are often quite similar, we suspect that, and we know in fact, they got there by different means. So this will teach us about how to both improve cotton and how nature creates a new structure.
And so if I'm, and correct me if I'm wrong, but cotton is the single cells. These are trichomes, aren't they?
Correct. Yep. Seed hairs.
Yeah, so trichomes, just for those who are not familiar with the botanical origins of this particular cell type, these are, if you feel the feel a leaf or feel the surface of a plant structure and you feel these little hairs or these little, maybe even little spines, those are trichomes, and they serve various roles in plant biology, whether it's defense against insect feeding or maybe even contain secondary compounds. But lots of different uses for trichomes, and the cotton fiber is really a modification of a trichome. And so when you're looking at the genetics and genomics of this, do you find a lot of the genes that play a role in cotton improvement to be overlapping with those that have been described in trichome function?
There's certainly similarities in the developmental program, but one of the interesting things about developmental programs is that they're overlapping and similar between species, but malleable by evolution and with different players in, that can enter into and leave developmental programs. So one of the things we're trying to do is to understand developmentally what that developmental program is for each species and then how they differ from each other. So how nature has created these different structures and how people have modified them and the genetic architecture that they've changed in practicing strong directional human selection for longer, stronger, finer white fiber. There are similarities with, say, trichome development in Arabidopsis, but there's very many differences as well.
You mentioned that this is New World and Old World. And yeah. So this is really kind of an interesting thing. So what do we know about the ones that, which one was first and how did the other one get there?
This is a wonderful classic botanical mystery. And it's actually why I first started working on cotton about 30 years ago. If you look at, I mentioned that there's about 50 species and they're distributed in the warm, arid to sort of semi-arid regions of the world. And these are wild shrubs to small trees, just tremendous diversity. And they all have the same chromosome number. They're all diploid with a haploid number of 13 chromosomes. There's a tremendous genome size variation. Even though they all have the same chromosome number, they range up to threefold different in genome sizes, in DNA content per nucleus. And that's been really fun to figure out what's been going on there. But we've used molecular phylogenetic techniques to figure out how all these species are related to each other, and then to gain some insight into the remarkable transoceanic voyage that took place about 1 or 2 million years ago, where something in what we call the A genome, which is African and Asian diploid species, some entity, some plant, some propagule, some seed or capsule, managed to make it across the ocean, either the Atlantic or the Pacific, and we don't know which, but it made it to the New World. And there it encountered one of the D-genome cottons, another diploid, that was growing in what we think of as Western Mexico, what we think was likely Western Mexico. And these two lineages had not seen each other, as it were, for 5 or 10 million years. So they had diverged for 5 or 10 million years, but they underwent hybridization and genome doubling. So you have this biological reunion among diverged genomes to form a new lineage of plants. And these are the allopolyploid cottons. And they formed about 1 or 2 million years ago. And then much later, about 5 to 7 thousand years ago, humans independently domesticated two of the species that trace to this single origin of this New World tetraploid clade that had double the number of chromosomes of its ancestors. It's this incredible story that we've been trying to piece together now for about 30 years.
That's really great. And I think, let me just maybe break something down a little bit for listeners who aren't familiar so much with when we discuss ploidy, that typically when we think about our chromosome composition as humans, we have a complement from a maternal source and a complement of chromosomes from a paternal source. So you get you have a total number of chromosomes where you get a little bit from each parent. And you see this in diploids. Okay, this is what we call diploid, one bit from each parent. And what's happened in cotton is the diploids can, and happens in many plants, is that the diploids can sometimes get together in ways where they each retain all of the chromosomes rather than getting half from your mom, half from your dad. You get the whole set from one parent and the other. And so that's what you're seeing when you're mixing something like cotton with an A genome, which is the whole genome from the one parent, and the whole genome from the D parent. And this gives an opportunity for a plant to do some rather interesting things, because polyploids tend to have some rather elevated characteristics in many cases. And so here's a really interesting example. And what's really cool and is that you're mentioning that you went back to that these two plants hadn't seen each other in terms of their genomes. They've been diverging for, did you say, 10 million years about?
Yeah, we think 5 or 10 million years.
So for millions of years, these things separated, and then we're still able to get together and be interfertile, which is really kind of an amazing feat, and all of this before humans. So that's pretty cool.
Kevin, one dimension of this that's sort of interesting to think about is that even though it's the New World cottons and one in particular, and I can break that down for you too, that presently sort of dominate world cotton commerce and are the world's most important fiber plants, that trade actually originated in Africa. And it's only because it managed to cross the ocean and hybridize with a New World plant where it enabled sort of an amplification of that trait to make it even bigger and better than it was at the diploid level in Africa, in its new home in the New World with a double genome. One of the two New World polyploids, tetraploids, was domesticated, we think, in the northern Yucatan Peninsula, which is where you find the wild forms, actually growing right down there in the salt spray zone. And the other polyploid was domesticated in northwestern South America, also in probably where it grows in a very arid coastal area.
And so the domestication took place by people, indigenous people at the time. And so what about the major traits, and how was domestication really enhanced because of the polyploid nature coming from a complement from, say, Africa?
As I mentioned earlier, there's a whole series of sort of plant architecture traits that humans changed over time from these tall, photoperiod-sensitive, tropical, rangy shrubs that don't bear very many flowers at any one time, over thousands of years to these modern, short, annualized row crop plants. You can plant and harvest every year. One doesn't grow them as perennials. They're highly floriferous. They make abundant, strong, fine, long, white fiber. So there's all these, this is a correlated set of traits that humans have selected over thousands of years. And this really picked up in the last, say, since European invasion of the New World, where this sort of annualization pressure picked up and the modern cotton crop was developed. And there's a whole social history here. We couldn't have done it without slaves, et cetera, et cetera. So there's sort of a tragic social dimension to this whole New World cotton domestication history. And then only in the last several hundred years did that species of cotton, the one that dominates cotton commerce today, spread worldwide. It's actually supplanted the majority of cotton cultivation in the old world of indigenous varieties. So it's Gossypium hirsutum. That's the common, that's upland cotton. That's the one we grow today everywhere. That's the one of your blue jeans and Q-tips and T-shirts. And that's probably somewhere over 94% of global cotton commerce today. And most of the rest is the other tetraploid. Gossypium hirsutum, Gossypium barbadense, which is Pima cotton or Egyptian cotton. Very expensive sort of luxury threads. It has extremely long and fine fibers. Now notice it's the two New World cottons that are chosen by weavers and the whole textile industry. And that's because they're better than what could be created at the diploid level. So there was something about the biological reunion of these two diverged genomes that allowed selection to create something that looked better than the parents.
What other traits potentially are an effect of this hybridization between the old world and new world?
Well, that's a very good question. We know that they're all the fiber characteristics that are desirable to a breeder: fineness, length, yield. They all look better in the tetraploids than they do in the diploids. The seeds are bigger. They can make more oil for the oilseed industry, although that's not a particularly economically, that's not the part of the crop that is most important. And then I guess I would have to plead ignorance to maybe the rest of your question. We suspect that polyploidy is associated with many other kinds of adaptations, but we're just beginning to explore that. We, meaning the scientific community, is just beginning to get a handle on experimental techniques and sort of a conceptual framework for beginning to explore that question.
I guess cotton breeding is still a really vibrant area of inquiry, and how much interest is there now in maybe making synthetic polyploids or maybe finding, generating introgressing in old world traits or changing around maybe new world traits, changing the genetics for traits like disease resistance and other traits that may be found in some of the wild species?
That's a very good question. There's been a historical interest in that. And in fact, a lot of the old world diploids and in the new world polyploids, there's been a history of interspecific introgression and all kinds of fancy techniques like hexaploid bridging to bring in traits from, such as including those you mentioned, disease resistance from wild species. There's a lot of interest in, because of, for obvious reasons, in salt tolerance and drought adaptation. I mentioned that a lot of these wild species grow in arid to semi-arid areas, so there's a lot of potential there for transferring those adaptations to cultivars for cotton, for the cotton industry. So I would say that's both a historical and an ongoing industry interest in the industry. I am standing on the shoulders of generations of botanical explorers, taxonomists, entomologists, cytogeneticists, systematists, and bringing sort of new technology and molecular genetics to bear on a story of biodiversity. And so unless we had people who were actually exploring what's out there in nature, we wouldn't know any of this. And so I don't know, that's maybe too political a concept to get into in your show. But I think we know what we know now about commercially important cotton because of basic research.
And I think it's a perfectly fine comment in this particular context, because I think it is important for us to continue to advocate for public funding of science and public science playing a tremendous role, and basic science being so pivotal in helping us define the questions that we would ask in a more applied way, or to even give us a thread that we could grab onto as applied scientists and start.
Oh, I like your pun. I like your pun.
Oh, yeah, my thread. That's right. It's cotton we're talking about.
Very good.
No, very true. And so I think your point is extremely well made. And I all the time recognize the idea of standing on the shoulders of giants, because we're just the fortunate beneficiaries of having the tools and the resolution and the detection that we have that people back, probably people way, way wiser and smarter than me, that if they had these tools back a century ago, where we would be today would be phenomenal.
I still think we have a lot to learn from studying the wild plants and learning about ecological situations and adaptations. Take, for example, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't even know that the whole planet was ruled by 21 nucleotide RNAs. Now we know these microRNAs govern everything. Imagine exploring those and their functions in diverse wild species, what we have to learn.
Yes, so there's a long way to go. And I know that when, you know, I call the podcast Talking Biotech, yet I step back from biotechnology to really talk about the fundamental foundations of our major crop plants, because I just think it's so interesting. But how is biotechnology, and I'm not talking transgenics, but how is biotechnology in terms of marker-assisted breeding or even just the ability to sequence genomes? What are some of the major ways that it has influenced your ability to dissect these evolutionary origins and ecological interactions?
Yeah, I love that question. When I started working on cotton, we didn't know a single nucleotide of the genome. We had 60 or 70 morphological markers that have been classically described by geneticists and cytogeneticists working, who they just saw mutants in the field and they would make crosses, they'd study the segregation and figure out the inheritance and they'd name a gene. Now, just in the last 3 years, we have sequenced both diploid lineages that gave rise to polyploid cotton, and now we have published genome sequences for the tetraploid cotton as well. So now we know all 2 billion 700 million nucleotides in the cotton genome, and that's immensely empowering. So we can find genes quickly. We know where they are. We can study segregation. We can figure out relationships much more quickly because we have all these A's and T's and G's and C's. We can line up and quantify and measure relationships. So see, these are just immensely empowering tools that we can use for any kind of objective, be they determining evolutionary relationships to tracking introgressed chromosome segments in breeding programs. So, for example, we know there's a history of introgressing Gossypium barbadense into Gossypium hirsutum. But we don't know what the genetic basis of the traits that were actually selected. So now we can go in and we can resequence the pedigrees and we can figure out what genes gave rise to these particular traits of interest. Another thing that's very interesting that I haven't really touched upon is that at the diploid level, everything has the same number of chromosomes, but a threefold difference in DNA content. What's that about? They have the same number of genes. Why do they have a threefold difference in DNA content? And what is that doing? Think how much we have to learn about the functional consequences of all that extra, as it were, repetitive DNA. And what that might teach us about traits in the polyploid, where these two divergent kinds of genomes are suddenly reunited in one nucleus. Oh, and by the way, in only one of the two parental cytoplasms. Here's another neat one-liner. New world cottons contain old world cytoplasm.
Yeah, so what that basically means from a botanical sense, for those who don't know this field really well, is that the maternal contribution came from the old world. And so all of the organelles, like the mitochondria, the chloroplast, those are from the old world, whereas a lot of the genes that are in the nucleus come from the new world. And the new world genetics inside that nucleus need to be able to communicate and correspond with these external little organelles and coordinate the way they work together. And sometimes it's that differences and that sometimes disparity, sometimes enhancement of coordination between the mitochondria and chloroplast and the nucleus that can have some rather interesting traits. So maybe that's a foundation for some of the domestication origins. So Jonathan, you've been studying this for a long time and going back, going back decades. And with all the changes that you've seen and all the explosion of new information and going from, very simple techniques to much more today genome level tools, is there still a lot more for us to discover? And should people still be thinking about science as a viable place for discovery?
I think that a lot of students are afraid to go into science or genomics or any aspect of science because they think we already know everything and that all the low-hanging fruit has been plucked. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. I think we're just entering the growth phase in our understanding of the complexity of biology. I think that we are just sort of at the very beginning of the golden era of biology. And it's been enabled by technology, the sort of technology conceptual circle that reiterates. And so technology can drive new conceptual thinking, which can drive new applications of technology. And that leads to understanding and enhancements of understanding in ways that we can't yet anticipate. So I really truly do believe that we're just beginning to set the stage for understanding something as fundamental as how a plant makes a cell. And that, of course, is what a cotton fiber is. So cotton is a wonderful model for how a plant makes a cell. And who knows how that knowledge is going to be useful for something like the biofuels industry.
Okay, so thank you again to Dr. Jonathan Wendell for being with us on Talking Biotech. He's a distinguished professor and chair of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University and an expert in cotton.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, and I look forward to listening to tuning in to the Talking Biotech podcast.
Yeah, thank you. And I hope to see you pretty soon at a conference or something because it's been a long time. So nice to see you again.
Great. Thanks, Kevin.
Dr. Jonathan Wendell. So that's really the close of Talking Biotech Episode 4. And thanks again to Neil Carter. And not Nell Carter. former TV show, Neil Carter, and Dr. Jonathan Wendell, as well as our first co-host, Dr. Karen Cyphers. I'm Kevin Folta. Thank you for listening, and look forward to sharing more science with you next time on Talking Biotech.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.